So you like to listen to people talk about crime, but did you ever wonder why criminals do the things they do? Like what makes them tick? My name is Debbie, and I'm the professor at True Crime University. Join me in the classroom Thursdays, wherever you get your podcasts, for intellectual discussions about crime, psychology, and why criminals do what they do. See you there.
Down this road is a small city once thriving and full of life, but now desolate and abandoned. Well, abandoned save for the horrors rumored to reside within, which I presume is why you're here. Now, there's nothing wrong with a little morbid curiosity, but please, remember to stay close to your guides. We wouldn't want anyone to get left behind now.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Nopeville. Wonderful city filled with all the horrible, terrible things that make you say, nope.
Nope.
We are your tour guides. I'm Christine.
I'm Jen.
We know it's been a while. We're so sorry. We missed out on our favorite month of the year.
We're clawing our way through all the cobwebs that have taken over Nopeville.
Yes.
Luckily, everything is still contained as far as we can see.
Yes.
But. It's dirty.
And also, as a result, with real life being what it is, we're going to be taking a very brief break. Again, We're very sorry, but we will be returning. The goal is beginning of March, so keep your eyes and ears peeled for our return everywhere.
Look at our social meds.
Yep. Go to our social medias, Nopeville Cast on Twitter, Nopeville Podcast on Facebook and Instagram. We will be there, sort of. Those have kind of died a little too, but that's okay.
Well, Twitter's just a clusterfuck right now anyway.
Yeah, we all know what's going on over there. So we're just...
It's a dumpster fire.
We're just kind of... Even the inhabitants of Nopeville don't want really much to do with that. We do still exist over there, but, you know.
But you can always reach out to us on our email or our contact us form if you have any questions or you have any stories you want to share with us that we can do on our campfire upon our return.
Or any paranormal investigators that want to reach out and collab with us at some point as well. We'd be more than happy to have you on our haunting hour.
We've been doing some paranormal investigating ourselves.
Which brings us to what today's tour is. Yeah. This location is near and dear to Jen's heart, and I have grown fond of it as well recently. It is the Whaley House in Old Town San Diego.
Yay!
We've been meaning to do this, but we knew that it was an option to investigate it, so we wanted to do that before we brought you everybody else's hauntings.
Yes, and I've done it 3 times.
I've done it twice, and we plan to do it privately at some point.
Yes. So we just did their public tour, and it's public in that they cap it at like 10 people per investigation, and it's not too bad.
Yep. And if you're lucky, you'll get some nice, courteous groups like we did, and the guide is amazing. His name is Sam.
Shout out to Sam. I highly recommend doing that. And I think Sam does all the paranormal investigations, right?
As far as we're aware, he's the only one who does any of the nighttime stuff that happens at the Whaley House. So tell him we said hi.
Yeah, tell him we sent you. He's well aware of us now.
Yes, poor guy.
We bothered him enough times.
All right, so today we will be starting off with our dear historian, Jen.
Ooh, I guess that's what I am now.
Kinda.
I'll take it. I earned my Boy Scout badge.
In history?
Yes.
Haunted history.
Reminds me of the little kid from Up. I have this badge.
I have this badge, and this badge, and this badge.
All right, the Whaley House. So the Whaley House, as tour guide Christine said, is located in San Diego, California, in an area called Old Town. Actually, just a couple blocks away from the Cosmopolitan Hotel that we've had a previous tour and a paranormal investigation of. Construction on the Whaley House began on May 6, 1856, a luxurious two-story Greek Revival-style home designed by Thomas Whaley. When he began construction on his home, he declared, quote, "My new house, when completed, will be the handsomest, most comfortable, and convenient place in town or within 150 miles of here."
Interesting.
Very specific, very bold, but you know what? He did it.
He's not wrong. It is a lovely home.
When it was completed, it was furnished with mahogany and rosewood furniture, Brussels carpets, damask curtains, and made with bricks literally created by Thomas Whaley's personal brickyard.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you don't have one, you make it yourself.
Of course. That's how they did it back in the day.
And that's exactly what he did. So what he did is he bought two brick-making machines from New York for $2,500.
Wow.
And utilized the clay deposits and sand from part of the 8.5 acres he owned in Old Town, and utilized seashells from the beaches of San Diego to use as plaster for the walls. Apparently, seashells had to be used for plaster to reinforce the bricks since San Diego doesn't have lime deposits.
Huh, really?
Yeah. So they literally use seashells.
That's crazy.
For plaster. Right? Isn't that cool?
I didn't even know that was a thing you could do.
Yeah. But then he also used the ground around the Whaley House to make the bricks that built the Whaley House, which again is another fascinating thing to me.
See, that's one of those things that, like, in the very, very back of my mind, I know that's a thing that people do and can do, is just like take elements of the ground and make it into stuff to actually make a home. But like, it's not something that you immediately think of ever.
Yeah, you never think of how the sausage is made.
Right.
It's just there.
And you're like, just eat it.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah.
You didn't. Much. Sometimes you don't want to know.
True. As it stands, the Whaley House still has the original woodwork you can admire as you saunter through its historic halls. It was all cut elsewhere and to be shipped to this location in metal boxes to keep it safe from rats on the ship. Back then, perishables were packed in barrels of flour, grain, or anything else that could provide a cushion to protect the pieces. Therefore, you can imagine it wasn't that cheap to get this stuff over here.
Right.
Once it was completed in 1857, the construction cost totaled to over $10,000, which today would be just over $340,000. But compared to current home prices in San Diego, that's still not that bad, to be honest.
No, it's not. That's like what my parents paid for a home.
Yeah, that's like a third of the median home in San Diego right now. Yep. But anyway, I digress. Inflation sucks. It was said to be the finest home of its kind in Southern California, and it was the first brick building to be erected in San Diego County.
So he wasn't wrong. It was the handsomest home.
He was not wrong. It was the handsomest within 150 miles.
Weird word to throw out there.
The roughly 3,600 square foot two-story home was considered a mansion for its time.
Hmm, that's interesting. Having been in the house, that is very interesting. It's like a three-bedroom home. That's crazy.
That is a mansion, yeah. Compared to like the Winchester House. Look what's going on over there. Thomas Whaley was a great businessman. He found opportunity wherever he could, and it showed in the fact that while the Whaleys lived in the home, parts of it were rented out and served as a granary, a general store. Rooms were rented out for long-term and short-term stays. It was also the second county courthouse, San Diego's first commercial theater, a ballroom, a schoolhouse, a billiard room, a polling place, and a storage for official court documents and records for the San Diego County government. So he's just like, I built this thing. Use it as you may.
Do whatever you want with it. It's space.
And while you're doing I will live right there. Exactly. Yes,
you just gotta pay me for doing what you want to do.
Mm-hmm. But first, who is Thomas Whaley? And why was he important enough that his family home was turned into a museum that we can still visit over a century after his death?
Who indeed?
Thomas Whaley was born October 5th, 1823 in Manhattan to Father Thomas Alexander Whaley Sr. and Mother Rachel Pye. He came from a Scots-Irish family that immigrated to Plymouth, Massachusetts in 1722. His great-grandfather, Alexander Whaley, participated in the Boston Tea Party in 1773. He was also a gunsmith and provided flintlock muskets for soldiers during the Revolutionary War and allowed General George Washington use of his house when he was in Long Island.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Thomas Whaley Sr. continued the family business as a gunsmith and also served in the New York militia during the War of 1812. His wife Rachel's family owned a lock manufacturing business, and the Pye and Whaley firm was established after they married. When Thomas Whaley Sr. passed, his older sons John and Henry took over the family business along with their mother Rachel. For Thomas, who was only 7 years old at the time, it was his father's wish that his son receive a formal education. Thomas Whaley went on to get that education at the Washington Institute, where he acquired part of his business acumen. After he graduated, he toured Europe solo for a little while, and upon his return, he wanted to live on his own. He found a room for rent at Madame Victoria Delaney, where Thomas met her younger daughter, Anna Eloise Delaney. Anna was a student at Mrs. Green's School for Young Ladies and was an accomplished musician who played the piano, guitar, and melodeon.
Love at first sight.
At the time, Anna couldn't speak a word of English, as she only spoke French. Thomas was infatuated with Anna, and he began courting her. Anna's first letter she ever wrote in English was to Thomas.
Oh.
At the ripe old age of 8.
So gross.
So, Thomas Whaley is about 9 years older than Anna, so he was like 17 at the time he started courting her, and she was 8 years old. So, yeah, there's that.
So, like, an age gap of 9 years, it doesn't sound bad in a certain
perspective. It doesn't sound bad, but when you're 8 versus 17.
Right, exactly. So, when people say age is just a number, or, like, you know, age gaps aren't really a big deal, it's typically applied when you hit the age of 20. Yeah. So, it's really weird.
Yeah. The 1800s were a different time, so.
That's true, for sure, for sure.
Enchanted by the thought of success and riches of the California Gold Rush, Whaley headed to San Francisco in 1849, where he opened up his own general store. While still technically courting Anna, he didn't want to marry her until he was able to be financially successful and capable to care for her.
Mm-hmm.
So he's just like, I'll be back for you in a few years. Let me make some money first, and then we're going to do this thing. So.
Yeah. By then, maybe she'll be old enough.
It's romantic.
It is.
He set up a mercantile store with his business partner, George Wardle, selling locks and hardware from the family business Pye & Whaley in New York. At the age of 26, he was so successful he was able to have his own store on Montgomery Street, have his own two-story residence, and operate a boarding house.
Mm-hmm.
However, this newfound success didn't last long. In May of 1851, a fire was started in an upholstery shop on Montgomery Street, nearly destroying the entire business district.
Oh, wow.
Whaley's businesses unfortunately fell victim to the fire, and Whaley lost everything. Instead of choosing to rebuild in San Francisco and not wanting to return to New York and feel like a failure, Whaley decided to explore the rest of California and head down south to Old Town San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
In 1853, he finally earned enough money to return to New York and marry Anna Delaney, which they did on August 14th, 1853.
Nice.
He partnered with a few others in the general store business, one of which being his own brother, Henry Hearst Whaley, and they called their general store Whaley and Whaley. Henry and Thomas didn't get along well, and Thomas eventually found out that Henry was swindling customers by overcharging for products so he could pocket the surcharge, and Thomas didn't like that, so he dissolved the partnership.
Well, that's good. At least he was an honest man.
Yep. In 1855, Whaley purchased 8.5 acres of land. Well, this land was once home to the town's gallows.
Oh, God.
During Whaley's time in San Diego between 1851 and 1852, he witnessed 3 hangings. One very notorious one was James Robinson, aka Yankee Jim, who was sent to his death for the attempted robbery of a pilot boat, and 2 other men who took part in a plot by local Native Americans to take back their land, named William Marshall and Juan Verdugo. Yes, Thomas Whaley came to San Diego, witnessed the hanging of these 3 men, and said, yes, this is where I'll settle with my future wife and children, and I'll do so right on this very plot of land.
This is where I want to make a home.
He was a businessman after all, and a deal is a deal.
You know, Zach Bagans would do it.
Yes. He'd do it, but for different reasons. Not because he got a good deal, but because people died there.
He would pay $7 million.
Yes.
To build there.
He would. Yes. The plot of land had its desirable aspects in that it was a corner lot with its own natural well, but many others weren't too keen on snatching it up for its vile history. Thomas was just like, well, you snooze, you lose, more land for me, watch what I'll do with it.
Right, exactly.
And he showed people. So, back to the Native Americans. In 1851, an uprising among the local Native Americans occurred, led by a man named Antonio Gata. Antonio Gata was a well-educated and multilingual man. He was educated at the Mission San Luis Rey and was chief of the Cupenos tribe. The uprising had been brewing for some time as the Americans were heavily taxing the Native Americans, but not producing anything that would help them out.
Like they do.
Yeah, so they were taxing them on land that was not theirs.
Right.
But anyway. The Native Americans were essentially being charged to occupy their own land.
Right, that's so disgusting.
Mm-hmm.
Hate it.
Other tribes in Northern California were said to be getting aid with their tax dollars. However, his tribe and other Southern California tribes weren't seeing any such benefit.
Mm-hmm.
Antonio Gata gathered the other tribes to rise up against the white settlers before more came to the land and imposed their taxes and governance on them. According to an LA Times article, he devised a 3-pronged attack where the combined tribes would attack Santa Barbara, Los Angeles, and San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
They would also attack Camp Independence along the Colorado River, since this area is where a lot of the Americans would be able to cross the river easily and come to their land.
Right.
He and other Native Americans entered the camp under the guise that they wanted to trade horses with the Americans. There were only about a handful of Americans in the camp, and there were hundreds of Native Americans surrounding the camp.
Mm-hmm.
So they could have easily overtaken them. However, one camp commander was suspicious of the transaction, and he refused entry to the Native Americans. When they refused to leave, he ordered his men to aim the camp's 1-pound howitzer, a long-range weapon similar to a cannon, at the Native Americans. Knowing their bows and arrows were no match for the heavy artillery, Gata ordered his people to retreat.
Mm-hmm.
Gata returned home feeling defeated when he heard that some Native Americans were going to attack Warner's Ranch. He was unable to participate since he fell ill. John Warner shot and killed two Native Americans in the attack and was able to get himself and his wife to safety. Gotta's son took part in the raid, killing Americans at a nearby hot springs. Gotta wrote to Juan Antonio, the chief of the Cuyas, to help with the war efforts. Chief Antonio wrote back requesting a face-to-face meeting. When Gotta showed up to the meeting, Juan Antonio had set up a trap.
Oh, shit.
Juan Antonio was jealous of the esteem that his people held for Gotta and decided to double-cross him and turn him in. Juan Antonio turned Gotta into General Joshua Bean.
Maybe that's why your people hold more esteem for Gotta,
because he's respected.
Fighting for your people, not the Americans.
Yep.
Okay.
Chief Antonio Gotta and his son were taken into custody and taken back to Old Town San Diego, where they were tried and found guilty of treason, murder, and robbery. To quote the LA Times article, quote, Gotta's defense attorney argued that his client couldn't have committed treason since he never swore allegiance to the United States, and he couldn't be guilty of murder since, as chief, he had the power to make war. End quote.
That's fair.
So he was guilty according to American laws, but he was not American.
Right. Yeah.
So, and he was on his own land that the Americans took from him.
Your laws mean nothing here.
Yep. So regardless, the Americans found Gotta guilty of all charges and convicted him to death. On the afternoon of January 19th, 1852, he was marched with his hands bound to a freshly dug grave at the local San Diego Catholic Cemetery called the El Campo Cemetery, just about a block away from the present-day Whaley House.
Mm-hmm.
He was knelt before this grave, and his captors urged him to say his final words. Gotta said, quote, Gentlemen, I ask your pardon for all of my offenses and accept yours in return, end quote. Seconds later, the firing squad of 12 men, one of which was Thomas Whaley himself, fired upon Antonio Gotta and he fell into the grave. The reason why we know Thomas Whaley was part of the 12 men in this firing squad was because there was a letter found that he wrote to his mother in January. He says, quote, The painful duty to fall to me is of the 12 to carry out the execution. So he was an eyewitness to all of it. So he was regretful to be part of it, but he felt like it was his duty as part of the community of Old Town.
Mm-hmm. So it's like that social pressure.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
As for his main accomplices, William Marshall and Juan Verdugo, they were hanged at the gallows on December 13th, 1851, less than a month prior to Gara's execution, of which Thomas Whaley was also a witness.
Mm-hmm.
James Robinson, or Yankee Jim, was a Canadian Frenchman who stood at an imposing 6'4", while the average height of the day was 5'5", Jim definitely stood out. One night, he and two of his friends, James Grayson Loring and William Harris, stole a rowboat belonging to Joseph Stewart and Enos Wall. The two men found their boat a few days later after it washed up on the beach a few miles down the coast. The boat itself was undamaged, so it's like they just kind of took it for a joyride.
They just borrowed it.
However, the three men were arrested and charged with grand larceny.
What the fuck?
At the time, the city had passed an ordinance that stated that any theft over $150 or $250 would be given a death sentence. Given that the rowboat did not have that monetary value,
I was gonna say,
the court added on to the crime that the men were stealing the rowboat in order to steal the much more valuable pilot boat, too. They were assuming that they took the rowboat to go get the other bigger boat.
Oh my god.
Which... then they could be tried for grand larceny.
They're like, we want to kill these men.
On August 18th, 1852, the court ruled, quote, Your jurors in the within case of James Robinson have the honor to return a verdict of guilty and to therefore sentence him, James Robinson, to be hanged by the neck until dead, end quote.
Is it really their honor, though?
Apparently. Despite the three men all taking part, Yankee Jim was handed the harshest of verdicts. His two companions, James and William, were sentenced to 1 year in prison, and after their sentence was up, they left San Diego and never returned.
Like, you're tall and weird. We're gonna hang you.
Pretty much. At first, Yankee Jim laughed about the sentence. He was even seen laughing throughout the trial because he felt the crime did not fit the punishment and that they were just trying to make a show of him.
Yeah, he's not wrong.
In fact, all the way up to the time when they put the noose around his neck, Yankee Jim was in denial that they'd actually kill him for stealing a rowboat that was found and returned to the owner undamaged.
Right.
The Catholic priest would visit him in his jail cell, telling him he needs to get his affairs in order before his death, but he still didn't believe he was actually going to die.
Right.
Unfortunately, once the courts made up their mind, the decree was unchangeable. On September 18th, 1852, Yankee Jim was taken from his adobe cell, placed on a wagon, and was taken to the town gallows accompanied by two Catholic priests. The gallows were made of two beams planted in the ground and a heavy bar across the top. The wagon parked underneath the beam and a rope was placed around his neck. He delivered a farewell speech to the crowd that gathered, of which Thomas Whaley was in attendance. He told the crowd he was a good man that had given piles of gold to help poor men.
Right.
At 2:45 in the afternoon, Sheriff Crosswaith ordered the wagon driver, Gustav Fisher, to drive. The old man whipped the mules and the wagon moved forward. It was said that Yankee Jim had kept his feet on the wagon for as long as possible, but finally they were pulled off. Since Yankee Jim was about a foot taller than the average man at the time, unfortunately the measurement of the noose wasn't correct for a man his size. Mm-hmm. When his feet came off the wagon, his neck didn't snap, giving him a quick death. No, instead he, quote, swung back and forth like a pendulum until he strangled to death, end quote.
So he hanged after Juan and William.
Yes.
And I remember hearing that Juan and William also strangled to death.
Yes.
So whoever...
They didn't fix it.
I was going to say, whoever created this gallows...
Doesn't know how to measure.
Is an idiot.
It's like, measure twice, cut once, and this guy just fucking eyeballed it.
Measured once, cut once, and was like, yep,
yeah,
that's it.
Probably didn't even measure at all. Just, yeah, that looks right. Yep.
That would hang me, so should hang everyone.
These were the only three men that were recorded to hang at these gallows, and all three of them did not have a quick death.
That's so sad.
Mm-hmm.
No wonder this house is fucking haunted.
Yes. And also, he made the bricks
I know,
from yeah. the ground that these happened
on. The house itself is made from the soil upon which these men died.
Yes.
So it is in the walls forever.
Yep. Because that brick not going anywhere.
No. No, it's not.
So the gallows were in the very spot where the archway inside the Whaley House parlor now stands.
Mm-hmm.
Anna and Thomas Whaley both believe that Yankee Jim haunted the home even when they lived there. They'd hear heavy footsteps around the house, and Anna would claim to see shadow figures roaming the hallways when she was alone in the home. It's said that when Anna and Thomas would entertain guests in the home, Thomas would mention the fact to his guests that as they stood under the very archway, hey, this is where Yankee Jim was hanged.
Sam likes to do that too. He's like, hey, that arch? Does that, Jim likes to hang out in there.
Yeah. Dark humor. It was later thought that the backstory of Yankee Jim being a thief and a murderer who killed miners after robbing them of their gold and trinkets was fabricated in an effort to get the crowd against him so that the court could justify their verdict. The fact that he also stood out in appearance among the average man of the time didn't help his case either.
Right.
After the Native American uprising, the San Diego area was kind of in a state of lawlessness, and the courts and the lawmen felt they needed to do something to show they were still needed and useful, and that they weren't afraid to put men to death for breaking the law. Unfortunately, Yankee Jim drew the short end of the stick there and was at the wrong place at the wrong time. If he's still haunting the Whaley House, I wouldn't blame him for wanting revenge for this wrongful death.
See, but like in that case, why didn't they hang the other two guys too? So like, why specifically this one man of the three people that committed the exact same crime was this one man? Why didn't you just hang all three? You're not opposed to it, clearly.
I don't know why they pinpointed Yankee Jim as being the ringleader. The only thing I can think of is because he was a foreigner.
No, I think that's exactly why. I just don't know why they didn't just get rid of all three. Like, if you're not opposed to killing people for nothing to prove that you have, unless maybe the idea was like, well, we're not overbearing in our judgments. Like, sometimes.
they're like, we have some sense of moral. Oh, do you?
Not everybody's going to die if they go to trial. Yeah, right.
Or just to kind of scare people where it's like,
yeah,
you will or you will not. Like, you're scared. It's a 50-50 shot.
Maybe. You never know.
It depends on how we feel that day.
These two got off, but this one didn't.
Yep.
Dumb.
So back to Thomas Whaley. In 1856, Whaley first built a single-story granary on the property he purchased with bricks made from his own brickyard, and construction on his home began soon after. He'd hired local Native Americans to do the brickwork and paid them in groceries from his general store that was in the plaza.
See, that's useful to them.
Yeah, I think so. At the time the home was built in 1857, Thomas and Anna had two children, Francis Hinton Whaley, who was named after his business partner, and Thomas Whaley Jr. Once the home was complete, he opened his general store on the first floor. It wasn't long after they moved into their new home that Thomas and Anna started hearing strange noises that go bump in the night. In a letter Anna had written to Thomas while he was away on a business trip in June 1857, she said, quote, I am often startled out of my sleep in the night, thinking you have come home, end quote. Gary. In January 1858, their younger son, Thomas Jr., fell ill and died of scarlet fever at the young age of 18 months, right in the nursery upstairs. 6 months later in June, Anna gave birth to their first daughter, Anna Amelia Whaley. But tragedy struck again when just 2 months after the birth of Anna Amelia, an arson set fire destroyed Whaley's business at the plaza.
I was going to say, I swear I remember hearing somewhere about there being an arson shortly after Thomas Whaley Jr. died.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Because I remember whoever heard it was like, wow, the timing on that.
Yeah, pretty much. This loss was devastating to the Whaleys, and they decided to go back to San Francisco and attempted to sell their home. At this time, a friend and colleague of Thomas Whaley moved in as caretaker and rented out the rooms to other tenants.
Mm.
The Whaleys had three more children over the years they were in San Francisco: George Hay Ringgold Whaley, Violet Eloise Whaley, and Corinne Lillian Whaley. Thomas Whaley also took charge of three government transports with stores in Sitka and Alaska, while Anna stayed with the children in San Francisco. In 1868, Thomas Whaley returned to Old Town San Diego to do some much-needed repairs on his brick home and convince Anna to bring the children back, and they try their hand there once more. Anna refused to move back since they had settled so nicely into San Francisco.
Mm.
Whaley was anxious for a buyer or a renter for his brick home, and that's when Thomas Tanner, leader of a traveling theater troupe, came into Whaley's life.
Ah, yes.
The second floor of Thomas Whaley's home was transformed into San Diego's first commercial theater, and the second floor bedrooms were rented out for the performers to live in. A set of stairs was built so theater patrons could go straight to the theater rather than walk through the Whaley's home, which Thomas Whaley was in the process of remodeling the main parlor downstairs.
Mm-hmm.
The theater was big enough to supposedly fit 100 to 150 patrons, quote, comfortably.
There is no way.
And I say that in air quotes. Because having been there...
Yeah, there is no way.
No fucking way that 100 to 150 people could fit there comfortably.
Maybe 50, and I still think it would be uncomfortably.
Yeah. And the stage is tiny.
Oh,
and
yeah.
The room is tiny.
Yeah. Very small room.
In October of 1868, a major earthquake shook Anna and the children, and she decided to move down to San Diego after all.
Oh,
she's
wow.
Like, fuck this.
Yeah, that's a place that's definitely going to be rocking.
Yeah. The Whaleys stayed on the first floor, and Tanner and his troupe stayed on the second floor. Tanner hoped to make the shows a weekly affair. After months of preparation, the theater opened for their first show on December 2nd at 8 p.m., with admission costing 75 cents for reserve seats and 50 cents at the door. Children were half price.
Wow.
It was, for all intents and purposes, a successful opening. The San Diego Union reviewed it, saying, quote, "The performance of this troupe on last Wednesday evening, considering the circumstances, was very creditable. The house was filled to utmost capacity, which is a matter of congratulation to the manager, and all seem pleased with the first attempt, in this place at least, a theatrical performance. Notwithstanding the perfectly apparent indisposition of Mr. Tanner, the bronchial affliction of Miss Soledad, the rawness of the novices, the defective musical arrangements, the want of capacity in the seating room, and the smallness of the stage, we may be pardoned for saying that our theater is a success." I'm like, that is a roller coaster ride of like insults and praise. I'm like, what are you trying to say?
It's a compliment sandwich, okay? That's how you're supposed to do it. You're supposed to compliment, give the critique,
the
and then more compliment. Yes. So that's how you deliver bad news in a kind way.
Yeah, that's what it really seemed like. And I'm like, this is fascinating.
But like, I was wondering what the conditions were, because it was like, we would consider this a success under the conditions.
Yep. Under these certain specific conditions that would not be successful otherwise.
Right. I will proceed to list them out alphabetically.
Unfortunately, the indisposition that was affecting Thomas Tanner didn't improve, and 55-year-old Thomas Tanner passed away on December 18th, just 2 weeks after their opening show. Regardless, the show went on one more time, and the troupe disbanded shortly after.
Oh, I thought there was only one.
Nope, they tried to do it again, and the San Diego Union said it was successful, but the Tanner troupe was no longer the Tanner troupe because Tanner was no longer a thing.
Now we're just a troupe. And I don't know if we can keep it together. We need a leader.
So they disbanded after the second time. The theater closed on February 20th, just 2 months after it opened. And by August of 1869, the county of San Diego was renting the space for storage of court records and to be used as a meeting space for the Board of Supervisors. The former granary was transformed into San Diego's second courthouse. After the theater closed, Whaley partnered with Philip Crosswaith and opened a general store on the first floor called Whaley and Crosswaith General Store. If Crosswaith sounds familiar to you, I mentioned him earlier.
Yep.
In the fact that he was the sheriff and executioner of Yankee Jim almost 20 years prior.
Mm-hmm. I was like, that name sounds familiar. I remember her saying that.
Mm-hmm. Ugh. Yep. And we only partnered with him to open up a general store in his home.
Because that makes sense. Two hats.
Unfortunately, this store wasn't successful and it closed.
Oh.
They had to liquidate all of their items. Whaley then turned the store into a saloon and purchased a liquor license that was to be renewed quarterly. You know, when life gives you lemons, You make liquor, I guess.
Yeah, you make a gin and tonic.
Now, you might be thinking, how can he sell liquor right next to the courthouse? It was an odd setup having the bar right next to it, but he offered only to operate the saloon when the court wasn't in session.
That makes
sense. The court was okay with that.
That makes sense.
They're like, all right, cool. As long as you kids aren't rowdy while we're doing some grown-up stuff, you're good.
So it's like, as soon as like court's out of session, so it's done for the day, the jurors can go next door.
Happy hour.
And get some drinks. Like, I need a drink before I make this decision, man.
Exactly. This is exactly how it worked out. In 1868, Newtown was starting to be established, and a movement began where they wanted to relocate the seat of government to Newtown. Old Towners refused to hand over the court documents, however.
Mm.
One night while Thomas Whaley was gone on business, men broke into the Whaley house through the staircase that led right into the old theater, now storage room, and they broke the French doors to gain entry. Anna Whaley was home, and the men held Anna at gunpoint on the stairs while the children were in their bedrooms upstairs and stole the records to move them to Newtown.
Sounds a whole lot like the law stuff wasn't working. Hanging people willy-nilly.
It only works when they want it to.
When they hang people willy-nilly, but they lost their gallows.
Yes.
Their super effective gallows.
Yeah. Despite Thomas Whaley writing numerous letters to the Board of Supervisors telling them that their rent agreement wasn't expired and that they needed to pay him for rent and the damages they did to his home, his letters were ignored.
Surprise, surprise.
After the court relocated to Newtown, Thomas Whaley closed the saloon and opened a real estate office in its space. He then transformed the place into a new schoolhouse to replace the one-room schoolhouse his children attended nearby. Because why not? Uh-huh. He had the space. He's like, well, I don't need this anymore. It's not a courthouse anymore.
He's like, ah, yeah, I want my kids to learn here.
Let's just, like, you know, work from home.
Exactly. We don't have to take you to school. It's right there. It's right next door. Yeah. Just go through those doors.
You literally have no excuse anymore. You wake up, you go downstairs. Like,
you wake up, you have breakfast, and you go to school.
Exactly. In 1873, Thomas had to return to New York to settle his late father's estate with his siblings since they had all not received their inheritance. The lawsuit dragged on, and Thomas Whaley was forced to be apart from his family for 6 years while it settled. Oh, shit.
What the fuck?
Yeah, I have no fucking clue what the fuck happened. Thomas Whaley's financials were also dwindling at this time, so he needed the money. While Thomas was away, Anna and the children kept themselves entertained with parties and gatherings. Anna loved music and loved entertaining guests. Eventually, Thomas returned home to his wife and children, who were now very much grown.
Like they do over the years, that you were gone.
The 6 years you were gone.
That's insane.
Yeah. George Whaley left the home in 1879 after getting into constant arguments with his father about wanting to be a musician. Thomas wanted his son to follow in his footsteps and be a businessman. He found refuge at a downtown dive bar and played his violin. He also adopted his mother's maiden name, Delaney, and dropped Whaley from his name. He later performed at the Horton Hall in 1880 and was well received, and it said that he was self-taught the violin for 2 years, and he did really well for himself.
Yeah.
So, music ran in the family. On January 5th, 1882, Anna Amelia Whaley and her sister Violet Eloise Whaley married in a double wedding to their spouses. Anna Amelia married her first cousin, John T. Whaley, the son of Thomas Whaley's brother, Henry Hurst Whaley, and Violet married a man named George T. Bertolucci. When Violet was on her honeymoon 2 weeks later, she woke to find a letter by her husband stating that he was leaving her after he discovered her family didn't have enough money to pay off his massive gambling debts. He admitted to being a con man that only married Violet for her family's money.
Well, at least he admitted it, I guess.
Yeah. George said he'd return to her once he got his shit together. However, Violet was ashamed and returned to her family. Her family forced her to divorce George, but being a divorced woman in that day and age was a death sentence. No one wanted to associate with Violet, and she never recovered from the humiliation she felt by being abandoned by her husband.
Mind you, she was only, what, 19? She was young, going through this
shit. Yeah, she was only 19, going through all this.
And an old maid, considered.
Yeah, of course you feel like your life is over.
Mm-hmm.
Especially at that time when a woman's worth was only who she was married to.
Yeah.
So on July 5th, she attempted suicide by throwing herself in the family cistern, but her father caught her and was able to rescue her and pull her out. She was then held in the master bedroom under suicide watch, essentially, and she continued to journal in her sorrow. Mm-hmm. She was diagnosed with melancholy, which is just a fancy word for depression.
Right.
Then on August 19th, 1885, at about 6:30 in the morning, Violet took her father's .32 caliber revolver with her to the outhouse in the back of the house, aimed it at her chest, and fired. At the time, her father was in the kitchen and had just called out to her asking if she'd like a peach. Then he heard the gunfire. He ran outside and saw what she had done and brought her back in the house and laid her on the couch in the parlor room. Violet had just missed her heart and hit her lungs. She spent her last minutes alive in complete silence until she passed away. Mm-hmm. She had written a suicide note that she was tired of life and quoted a poem by Thomas Hood called The Bridge of Sighs, saying, quote, "Mad from life's history, glad to death's mystery, swift to be hurled anywhere, anywhere, out of the world," end quote. And she is only 22 years old.
Mm-hmm.
At the time of Violet's death, her younger sister, Corinne Lillian, was engaged, but her fiancé broke it off for fear of scandal. After all the tragedy he encountered, Thomas Whaley decided to build a single-story home at 933 State Street in downtown San Diego, where he lived until his death on December 14, 1890, at the age of 67.
Damn.
The Whaley house remained vacant until 1909, when Thomas's son Francis decided to restore it, as it was left in disrepair for more than two decades, only being rented out occasionally to people who were just passing by. He reopened the home as a museum and tourist attraction, and he entertained visitors by playing the guitar. Anna, Corinne, Francis, and George Whaley all lived in the house again in 1912. Anna Whaley died in the house on February 24th, 1913, at the age of 80.
Oh, wow.
Francis died a year later on November 19th, 1914. Then George died January 5th, 1928. Corinne Lillian lived in the house until her death on September 14th, 1953. Anna Amelia Whaley passed away in Modesto, California, at the age of 45 in 1905.
Wow.
In 1956, the house was put up for sale and it was going to be demolished until Jim and June Redding stepped in and convinced the county of San Diego to restore the home and open it for public tourism again. The Whaley House Museum reopened in May 1960, and June and Jim Redding handled its operations until the Save Our Heritage organization took over in 2000. It's now owned by Historic Tours of America, and you can visit it today. I've gone probably over 10 times, mostly nighttime tours, now 3 paranormal investigation tours, which I highly recommend if you're ever in San Diego. They're great. The docents are all great. The house is really cool. They have a lot of, like, original furniture. Paranormal investigations are awesome. It takes place at, like, 11 p.m. to, like, 1 a.m.
It's one of her favorite things to, like, take people to when they visit her.
Yes. Come visit me. I take you to Whaley House. And we get some Mexican food in Old Town.
Oh, yeah.
Delicious. So that is the history of the Whaley House. Setting you up for all the paranormal stuff that's going to happen.
Yep. This is one of the most... No. This is the most haunted house in America.
America's most haunted house.
Yes.
As they advertise on the signs outside of it.
Yes, exactly. They've got, like, nice little lights on them and everything.
Ah, fancy. It's legit.
And as she mentioned, a lot of the family members were documenting that they were noticing that the house was pretty haunted even before they passed away. So, to start us off on the more chilling side of the Whaley House today, let's take a look at the time Ghost Adventures visited Old Town San Diego again to check out the most haunted house in America for themselves back in 2014. As far as I can tell, they were the first paranormal investigators with a film crew, at least, to do an investigation of the Whaley House back in season 11. During their preliminary investigation, they speak with the founder of the San Diego Ghost Hunters to discuss and look at a photo she had taken of what appeared to be an apparition of what could be a man coming in through the upstairs window near the door to Violet's room. Yeah.
Ew.
In this photo is also one of the head docents, Jokey Tolentino, whom they had spoken with earlier on and had told them she often sees figures around the house, but they are always turned away from her.
I wonder why.
When they asked her, she said something about, like, she figures it's kind of a way of, like, I don't bother them, they don't bother me. You know, they acknowledge that I'm not here to harm them, so they're just kind of doing their own thing, is the way she kind of viewed it.
Oh, okay.
They call her in to ask if she had ever seen the photo before, to which she says that she has not, and Zach and Nick tell her that once they realized she was the person in the photo walking toward the figure in the window, Nick made the connection with what she had told them earlier about how the spirits follow her around. Nick notes that it must feel kind of nice to have validation like that photo of what she has been seeing and experiencing.
I don't know if nice would be
my note. That's literally how he phrased it. He was like, it must be nice to have that kind of validation.
No.
That these things do, in fact, follow you around the house.
We should not be in gaslit, I guess.
Zach takes this one step further and says it's chilling to note that the figure appears to be looking away from Jokey, though I honestly don't know how he gets that from this photo, since the figure doesn't have any defining features of, like, where the head appears to be. Like, you can see where the head is, but there's nothing to tell you which way it's facing. There's no hair or anything like that to be like, oh no, it's definitely facing outside, but it's coming in, so...
Did he just get that from what she was mentioning, that when she sees them, they're usually facing away from her?
That's what I think. I think he saw that and was like, oh yeah, it's looking away from you.
Yeah.
During these interviews, I think is where the first ideas of Yankee Jim specifically targeting police officers comes from. As the founder lady from earlier on talked about, those being the kinds of people that would often end up with the marks around the neck as though from a noose. Mm. I remember at our last paranormal investigation, Sam mentioned that there's an idea out there that Yankee Jim seems to target police officers, but how would he know? Like, how would he know, A, that you're a police officer?
They have an air about them.
They have an air about them, yeah. Because, like, the officers nowadays, even if someone were to show up in uniform, they don't look the same as they did when he was alive. So,
going back to our last paranormal investigation with Sam, he showed us a woman that had the red marks around her neck.
Yeah. So, he showed us a photo and it was a woman's neck.
Officer, well, yeah.
He didn't say if she was a police officer or not, but, like, but we did see a photo of someone who had recently had that mark.
Yeah.
We also learn that one time in 1964, while Regis Philbin had been visiting the house, he claimed to have seen the apparition of Violet through the archway in the parlor.
Mm-hmm.
During these early interviews, Nick tells Zach about suddenly feeling as though he had pressure on his chest and like he couldn't breathe while he had been standing talking to Aaron. And that was the end
That's
of that.
What I felt.
When?
When we were in Violet's room that one time.
Oh, interesting.
We'll talk about our experiences after.
We do have some.
But we have some.
So after getting the stories of other people's experiences in the house, the guys get ready to make a game plan for their investigation and even mention bringing in Bill Chappell to join them for this one. If you don't know who that is, he's the man responsible for creating a lot of the gear that the guys use on their investigation, including the Ovilus and I think even the SLS camera.
Oh, okay.
So he is the creator of the Ovilus.
Nice.
Bill sets up an elaborate system of microphones and mirrors in the hopes of being able to use science to help make EVPs be audible in real time, so there's an ambient sort of humming sound from the system when they enter the house through the door at the back. Okay. So it's not a very quiet investigation.
So it's like having your spirit box on full blast.
It's not even like the spirit box per se. It's like having your digital recorder playing while you're talking. Does that make sense?
Interesting. Yeah. Like, it's just, like, some sort of baseline noise that, yeah, okay.
They get some interference with the lasers a couple of times, which results in a louder sort of static, but no actual, like, voices coming through or anything, although Zach claims to have heard a harsh whisper, which isn't picked up on camera.
Ew.
While Zach continues to try to communicate with whoever is in the room with them, they note that the energy felt like it shifted, and then soon after, a loud thud is heard upstairs.
Mm.
I'll be honest, I'm really glad we don't hear any, like, real loud banging sorts of noises whenever we've been in the house.
So we will talk about this, but the last one we went on was the first time I ever heard like shuffling with my naked eye.
with naked my eyes. Naked ear. I heard with my naked eyes.
Isn't that what you do with your eyes?
That's what I've been doing wrong all this time. I'm listening with my naked ears, not my naked eyes. Damn it.
You hear with your eyes.
Aaron hears footsteps coming from upstairs, which again isn't picked up, but he goes to investigate, and though he doesn't find anything, he says he can feel like something is up there. He sits down in the theater and comments on how the sound from the speaker system seems to be gradually getting quieter, which you can hear, when suddenly a weirdly, like, rhythmic sort of humming starts very briefly, and then a quiet male voice is picked up, seeming to say, no power.
Okay.
Zach proceeds upstairs to try and gently provoke Yankee Jim. He really does gently provoke, which is bizarre for him.
Gently provoke.
Into manifesting. And when he asks for the spirits to make a sound to show him where they are, Bill hears a thump from the master bedroom that is picked up by Nick's audio, but not heard by Zach.
Jeez.
So they can hear it downstairs coming from upstairs, but Zach, who is upstairs, doesn't hear it.
That's weird.
It is weird. Nick goes upstairs soon after this, and they initially think they hear a woman's voice, but debunk it as a squeaky step that Nick stepped on, which is kind of a funny thing watching Zach sort of like
shimmy about.
Yeah, shimmy back and forth on this one step to make it make the noise. Not long after this, the alarm inside the house starts going off about an hour before the team was told it would. And when Zach follows the employee inside to turn it off, as soon as it's quiet again, you can hear the whispered sound of a man's voice. This was one thing I definitely heard even before it was mentioned, and Zach says before they replay that they can't figure out what's being said, but I swear I heard it saying, he heard me.
Ooh.
Very fucking clearly. And you know how much hearing disembodied voices like this clearly unsettles me in these videos.
Yeah. And it's like, clearly an intelligent haunting because it's reacting to something that the guys did.
That they're doing right then. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
The alarm starts going off again about half an hour later, which they've been told is one of the way spirits let investigators know it's time to get the fuck out. Which Zach, of course, takes to mean they've hit a nerve. So he goes to the theater with Aaron to take some photos while Aaron just talks.
Mm-hmm.
After a while, Aaron leaves and Zach calls Nick to film behind him because he feels like nails are slowly moving down his neck and back and leaving a sort of electricity-charged feeling behind.
Oh.
He continues taking photos of the stage and catches one where white translucent hand with long nails seems to appear in the bottom right.
Ew, I don't like that.
Zach, of course, decides he wants to be alone with the spirit now. And while he feels the feeling on the back of his neck again as he moves onto the stage and makes his way to the master bedroom, he doesn't capture anything further, and that concludes the investigation.
Mm-hmm.
Moving on to 2017, Ryan and Shane of BuzzFeed Unsolved decided to pay the home a visit. And they've recently gone back again, but I kind of felt like Shane was a bit more respectful the first time around than he was this most recent time.
Yeah, with the new show that they have.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was purposely, like, fucking with Ryan.
Yeah, he was purposely knocking, calling hey, stuff like that. Like, he was deliberately just being, in general, kind of an ass.
Yeah.
The first time around, he still does that a little bit, but it's not that bad. Still, with their method of investigating, they didn't really turn up a whole lot of evidence worth noting here, but interestingly, Ryan heard a disembodied breath in his ear the first time and a disembodied voice saying, hey, the second time. Mm. So both times they got a disembodied something. But I mentioned the way they investigate because neither one of them seems to take it all that seriously. Like, Ryan is genuinely terrified of being there and doesn't want to communicate with anything, and Shane could care
less. Also, the second time someone said hello or hey to Ryan, too. So... whatever this thing is, wants to communicate with him.
Yeah, so twice Ryan has heard
something.
Both times
he was there, they said the same thing. Yeah.
Exactly. Other than that, the first time, Ryan got a strange feeling in one of the chairs in the jury box shortly after Shane's flashlight died, inexplicably.
Mm-hmm.
And the second time, they got some responses through the Estes method, but nothing that made any kind of sense.
Mm-hmm.
Next up, we have the Holzer files from back in 2019, so much more recently, but not nearly as recently as the YouTubers I found that have visited. So still back when the house was still mostly filled with original artifacts from when the Whaleys lived there.
Mm-hmm.
And let me tell you, this crew got some interesting stuff.
Oh, yeah. Because Hans Holzer was there when Regis Philbin was there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So now, if you've never watched this series before, like me, the premise is that a group of modern paranormal investigators have recently discovered or gained access to the files of one of the first ever ghost hunters, Hans Holzer. They go through the files and revisit the places he's investigated to verify or gain new evidence from these locations. This particular episode starts out with two of the investigators sitting with Hans' daughter, watching a film on a projector of a session that appears to be in the courtroom with medium Sybil Leek under a trance during a seance talking about someone having had control of Violet when she killed herself, saying, quote, "There's a great deal of confusion in this house. There's a young girl in the parlor. Chest trouble. Someone had control of her." End quote.
Oh, wow.
She goes on from that to say, quote, "People quarreled in this spot. He died here. Unhappy. He wants all this house for himself. He is laughing." End quote.
Is it Henry?
I don't know if it's Henry or Gata. Yeah. See, when you were telling me all the things you were finding, I had this episode in mind, and you're gonna get all kinds of things. At this point, they talk about Yankee Jim, introduce who he was and what the land was before Thomas Whaley built the house. Mm-hmm. And one of the investigators mentions having spoken with the director who owned the Whaley house at the time.
Mm-hmm.
This director had expressed a desire for the team to reopen the case since staff and visitors had been experiencing an increasing amount of activity within the home.
Mm-hmm.
For reference, the team is made up of psychic medium Cindy Kaza, equipment expert Shane Pittman, and paranormal investigator Dave Schrader.
Okay.
Cindy is sent up into the house with Shane, who is recording with a thermal camera, and Cindy, of course, is mentioned to be going in blind of the entire case, and the guys don't know anything outside of what was within the Holzer files.
Mm-hmm.
Cindy mentions feeling dizzy, and like this is a very active house, and also that she feels pulled to the parlor.
Mm-hmm.
She talks about feeling creeped out in what is currently known as the legacy room, and that someone either died in that room or spent a lot of time in there unwell, stating that the room feels heavy.
Ew, I don't like the legacy room.
And it was a bedroom.
Yes.
Once upon a time. Next, she feels pulled to the kitchen, where she says she keeps seeing a pool of blood, lots and lots of blood, and that she gets the sense that it's the woman she mentioned before who died a gruesome death, angry with her husband.
But why the kitchen?
Mm-hmm.
That's not where Violet
died. I know. I was thinking the same thing.
Huh. Is it because that's where Thomas had to bring her in through the door that was next to the kitchen? to get, bring her into the parlor?
That was my suspicion. But why specifically did she go into the kitchen? Granted, she was in the doorway of the kitchen when she was saying all this.
It's because Thomas was in the kitchen.
Or not the
cutting...
kitchen, the dining room.
Oh, he, Thomas, well, the kitchen's adjacent to the dining room.
Yeah.
But he was in the kitchen cutting peaches, and that's when he heard the gunshot. When he said, hey, Violet, you want a peach? And then boom. Oh,
yep.
Interesting.
She also says that she was feeling that this woman sensed she was left for another woman and that she felt betrayed. So betrayed, in fact, that she loses her mind completely.
Ugh, yeah.
Cindy proceeds upstairs, stopping halfway to say that the energy ahead of her feels unsettled and angry and crazy. When she reaches the second floor, she stops between Violet's room and the nursery and says she feels like she wants to do some automatic writing down on the bed she felt uncomfortable sitting on downstairs, so back in the legacy room.
Oh, interesting.
She sits down with a Sharpie and a legal pad on the bed in the legacy room, and after a moment, she starts writing several pages. You don't actually see what she's writing. Like, you can see her writing, but she doesn't write legibly.
Mm-hmm.
She starts writing several pages saying she feels a male and a female presence within the house that never seem to interact as though they each have their own separate realms that they exist within.
Oh.
She says that the man likes causing pain and seeing people hurt. Also that he affects electricity and is going to make the camera turn off. Not long after this, Shane's thermal camera turns off and he can't turn it back on.
That reminds me of what we got.
Yeah.
We will talk about that.
Keep that in your brain. Cindy says she doesn't like this guy and that she wants to leave, then stops mid-sentence staring past Shane, which of course he doesn't like because
Ew.
Nobody likes that.
No.
He asks what she sees and she says he's right there,
mm-hmm.
standing behind Shane and that she can see him.
Fuck no.
Shane points out that their brand new camera is dead and Cindy says they should get out of there.
Fuck. The fuck?
The next day, while speaking to Dean Glass, the historian, about the history of the house, he becomes hesitant in his speech while talking about Yankee Jim, and when Dave asks about this, Dean states, quote, "Even if they're not right here with me, they're hearing me, and I want to be careful what I say," end quote. Which struck Dave as odd, because why would a grown man be afraid of what some centuries-old ghosts think of what he has to say?
Because he's had a century to charge his power.
Well, also, I mean, he's obviously experienced some shit.
Yeah.
This makes him wonder about if Dean is the only one who has feelings like this, and they speak to an employee who had felt dizzy and fainted under the archway while he had been vacuuming the parlor.
Oh, wow.
The boy stated that when he came to, he suspected that perhaps he had done something wrong, and Dave clarifies that this kid's first thoughts upon waking up aren't along the lines of, am I sick? But instead more like, I must have done something to deserve this, which the employee confirms.
Mm.
Which is a... Again, kind of an odd way to think about that, unless something in there is making you think that way.
Yeah, like it's my fault, I'm the problem.
Right, like I shouldn't have been doing that.
Yeah.
Shane proceeds to play a portion of the seance with Sybil, where, when asked if there's anybody with her, she says, quote, "He does not like noise, except when he makes it. He will make even more noise unless you go away," end quote. So they suspect the sound of the vacuum probably pissed off the male spirit. Later that night, in an effort to confirm or deny if Yankee Jim is the dark presence within the Whaley house, Dave and Cindy visit the nearby graveyard, El Campo Santo, where he's allegedly laid to rest, and Cindy leads Dave to a random spot among unmarked graves and states that you can see two men planning an ambush to take back their land and a barn on fire. She also says that Yankee Jim is definitely not the dark force haunting the house.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Now you're understanding why I wanted you to look into him.
Yes.
The next day, Dave is presented with some new information explaining the things that Cindy saw in the graveyard the night before about Antonio Garda and Juan Verdugo and William Marshall. He is also presented with some letters from Anna Whaley confirming that the house was haunted even back when the Whaleys were living there.
Yep.
And that the house is doomed and possessed of evil spirits.
Yep.
Per Anna's actual writing.
Yep.
The night of the third day, the group of three does their investigation of the home. To start, Dave goes upstairs to the theater with a motion detection camera, essentially an SLS, while Cindy and Shane go to the downstairs bedroom with a thermal camera, so back to the legacy room with the two of them. Cindy feels the presence of a woman pacing behind her back, which is not picked up on the thermal camera, but up in the theater, Dave picks up a stick figure anomaly on the stage in front of him. Dave asks the anomaly to give him a sign that it can see him by raising its arm, and it disappears.
He's like, no.
Yeah, it's like, I don't want to do that.
So. No.
But when he plays back the audio on his audio recorder, because he was doing an EVP kind of session then, from that moment, a voice says, yes, very clearly as he says, let me know if you can see me.
He's like, I can see you. I'm not going to do your parlor tricks, but I see you.
Like, I ain't going to dance for you, but I do see you.
It's like, you didn't pay me 75 cents to be here, so I'm not going to perform for you.
You're just kind of here, not benefiting me in any way. They meet up again downstairs to talk more about the things Cindy is feeling, and while they are talking, you can hear a clear thud in another part of the house. Cindy starts feeling a tightness in her chest and like a man is standing behind her, so Dave asks if this is the energy that's been there, and another thud and some footsteps can be heard maybe by the stairs. Cindy says she doesn't like the feeling of the presence behind her and that he's just standing there being threatening, that it's the same man from the night before.
I don't like that.
She mentions that he's telling her, quote, I'm gonna fuck up his knees. End quote.
What?
And then she asks Dave if he has bad knees, which he confirms. She starts feeling like she's going to fall over and sits down in a nearby chair. A creak can be heard behind the guys shortly after that while none of them are moving. Mm. Now, mind you, Cindy has not learned any of the new information that Dave has learned. Mm-hmm. After hearing what she thinks sounds like John Vargas, Dave comments that that's very similar to Juan Verdugo. Mm-hmm. One of Antonio Gatta's men that had been hanged at the gallows where the arch in the parlor now stands. Mm-hmm. Cindy states that she thinks that might be who is the negative presence, and Dave says they're going to do an EVP session under the arch. Mm-hmm. While Dave asks his questions to Juan Verdugo, Cindy comments that he's laughing at them and has been the whole time.
Ew.
When Dave asks if he influenced Violet to commit suicide, Cindy says that he's repeating, quote, they took from me, now I take from them.
What the fuck?
Before she starts coughing, after saying that this is a thing that's happening, she starts to cough, and then a loud bang can be heard from somewhere else, and Dave says it sounds like a gunshot.
Oh, shit.
They decide this is a good time to listen back on the audio recorder, and when Dave's voice on the recorder says, quote, let us know that you're here now, there are a couple of bangs that were not heard during the session, and then he's shoved sideways into Shane and falls to the floor.
What?
You literally see this happen.
Oh, wow.
Now, the way this plays out honestly looks like what he says happened, that something shoved him. He leaves the house to clear his head, and Cindy tells Juan that his time is up and that it's time to go. She also mentions that the house is evil before she and Shane go out to check on Dave. Mm. Which kind of makes sense when you consider the fact that it is made from the very soil upon which these men died.
Yeah.
Dave makes a comment similar to a theory and a thought I've had since visiting the house to investigate ourselves and hearing about some of the other experiences, that this presence has been parading around this house under the guise of Thomas and Violet and Yankee Jim. But now they've given him a name and he's angry. Mm-hmm. While reviewing their evidence the next day, Shane shows Dave something he and Cindy had yet to find out about. After Dave left the house, after being attacked, Cindy had called out and asked, Juan Verdugo, is that you? In the recorder, the response that can be heard to that is a very deep, slow laugh that almost sounds demonic.
No thanks. Nope.
And that is the last piece of evidence they gathered from their time in the Whaley house.
Fuck?
Yeah, that one gave a lot to think about.
Yeah, especially our last investigation.
Now we move on to some of the YouTubers. Yay.
All right.
That have taken the opportunity to do private investigations within the house, something we're planning to do ourselves in the very near future.
Hopefully near future. Future.
We're hoping. I mean, the plan is there, though.
The plan's there. Yes.
First, we have a channel that's simply called Overnight, and they investigated back in February of this year. All of these investigations were this year.
Yeah, because for a few years, they stopped doing the paranormal investigations, so when they brought it back, I jumped on that shit.
Mm-hmm. So essentially, the premise of this channel seems to be like this group of four friends, Elton, Corey, Corbin, and Matt, and in their overnight series of haunted locations, they film in the house overnight for 8 hours, and stuff starts happening pretty much right away for them. Mm-hmm. As their guide is talking with them in the legacy room, the curtain dividing this room from the parlor falls down behind Elton for no apparent reason.
Falls down?
He's not touching it. What it just fuck? Fell.
Okay.
Yeah. And one of the camera guys' lights die. While they're talking about the dead light battery, the sound of something scraping along the floor right above their heads can be heard.
Like furniture moving?
Mm-hmm.
The fuck?
Yeah. And that's like the nursery?
The room right above the legacy room is Violet's room, yeah.
That's not okay because there's nothing in there that can be moved around.
Nope, okay. Not right now.
Not then.
Mm-hmm.
After finishing their tour of the house, the guys accompany their guide outside and do a short trivia quiz to decide which three will later walk to the El Campo Santos Cemetery down the street to see where Yankee Jim is buried.
What was involved in this quiz?
They're very easy questions, but it's whoever like raised their hand first.
Okay.
And whoever was the last person to not get a chance to answer was the one who has to stay alone in the house while the other three go to the cemetery for the entire length of the time it takes them to get there and come back. Corey ends up losing.
Because it gets dark in there when all the lights are off.
Yeah. And no, the camera guys are leaving too. Like, it's literally just him. He doesn't have light. I don't remember if he has a flashlight with him or not, but he's just alone. But this is the one thing that's going to happen later in the episode. So the boys, all four of them, well, technically six, re-enter the house. Corey claiming to have seen someone. So he had like disappeared to go to the bathroom. Mm-hmm. As he's walking into the house to rejoin the gentleman with him, he swears he sees someone sitting at Thomas's desk.
Ooh.
And he thought it was one of the guys. But then when he saw where the guys were and he looked back at the desk, there was nobody there. So he saw an apparition, like a full-bodied apparition, just sat in a chair at the desk.
Which Sam says the desk is a trigger object because that's actually Thomas Whaley's desk.
Yeah, so it could have been Thomas.
Yeah.
He said whoever he saw sitting there was just wearing black. The four then decide to do a seance in the courtroom to open up communication. Just as like a friendly, hello, this is who we are, and we are here to say hi.
Okay.
Corbin suddenly gets up and leaves with stomach pain, which Elton worries is a huge no-no, similar to leaving a Ouija board session without saying goodbye.
Yes.
Not sure if that's true. They just didn't know. They tried to close it in a way.
Any kind of communication session you're doing, you have to close it. You can't just walk away. You have to say, okay, thank you, we're done, goodbye. Like any type of communication session, Ouija, seance, EVP, all that stuff.
Yeah. As long as you do it before you leave.
Yes.
The building.
But I feel like something like a seance and something like Ouija board, like they're actual sessions that can have an opening and a closing too, versus when you're just doing your investigation and you're doing EVPs, spirit box, things like that. And at which point then you can just do your
as you leave
overarching goodbye as you leave. But like, I feel like a seance and Ouija board session have like a certain formality to them that can have the opening and closing.
Yeah. Like you're connected. Like he gets up, breaks the circle and leaves the building.
Yeah. And that stomach pain could be something forcing him to break the seance to get away from everybody. Yeah.
So while Corbin seems to be throwing up in the bathroom outside, Elton speculates that Matt is the next one to have something happen to him since something has happened to the other three. And while they're talking about this, the cat ball they set up on the table starts going off as well as the one on the...
What was his final destination?
Judge's bench behind him.
Take off one at
They're like confirming. They're like, yes, it's his turn. When Corbin leaves the bathroom, Corey asks him if he's okay and what happened, and Corbin tells him it just suddenly felt like something was stabbing him in the stomach.
Ooh.
When Corbin returns to the courtroom, the REM pod, which had not gone off at any point yet, starts going off. Just out of nowhere, when this one gentleman walks in. Elton teases right from the beginning that he's brought along something incredible to aid them in their investigation, and it has been sitting on the judge's bench covered up since before the other three entered the building. When he starts slowly pulling off the velvet covering to reveal a second covering, both cat balls go off simultaneously. So again, the one on the table and the one on the judge's bench.
The cat balls are really active.
Something's excited.
In the Whaley house, yeah.
He pulls off the second covering to reveal the Annabelle doll in her case.
Great. Why?
Yay.
Can't be the real one.
It's not, but he doesn't say that until the end.
They're not going to give it. What's his name? Tony? Tony's not going to give it to him.
I know. At this point, Elton decides it's the perfect time for the three guys to leave Corey alone in the Whaley house while they go to the cemetery. So he unveils this Annabelle doll and he's like, all right, we're going to leave now. Bye. Corey decides to hang out in the parlor to keep himself away from Annabelle, and he sets up the music box on a nearby chest to point at the space in front of him while he sits on the couch at the front of the parlor. So he's like at those front windows. The music box goes off briefly, and not long after that, clear footsteps can be heard further in the house. More footsteps, and maybe like a thud, kind of like a door closing, can be heard, and then the REM pod starts going off.
Where's the REM pod at this point?
If I remember right, it was under the arch.
And he's in the...
Because it wasn't like right next to him.
By the front window?
Yeah.
Okay.
And the music box is on the chest, like right there under that window.
Mm-hmm.
Corey asks for confirmation that the spirit he had seen earlier was Thomas Whaley, but none of the devices go off. So he asks if perhaps it was another spirit.
Yep.
And the REM pod starts going off again. It stops as soon as he asks whatever is there to stop touching it.
Oh, polite.
This happens again when he asks for confirmation if the entity is an adult. Adult.
Behind.
Soon after this, the others return and they all get something to stand in front of the music box to keep it going by promising it they'll dance with it. And they do. While the music's going, they're dancing.
Hey, that's like when you were dancing with Not Peter at the Cosmopolitan.
They really seem to enjoy that. They like when you interact with them instead of just talking at them, it seems like. They ask whatever it is to step away from the music box so they can ask questions, and it does. So it had been going off nonstop up until they said, okay, now can you step away? And it stopped.
No.
It sets the music box off again when they ask if it was executed on the property, and again when they ask if they're standing in the place it was executed as they move up to the arch. Soon after, the music box stops working. Like, the lights keep lighting up, but the crank isn't cranking at all.
That's weird.
Yeah, it was a bizarre one.
Yeah.
Because they went to go check and see if, like, if the track had been removed, and that was fine. Mm-hmm. It just stopped cranking.
That's weird.
So they move upstairs to the master bedroom to do the Estes method, and after a few responses that don't make much sense, they seem to be communicating with Violet, hearing words like sadness and my heart. Mm-hmm. But while they're speaking with her, their GoPro dies, and the light in the nursery shuts off.
Ew. You're not allowed in the nursery either. Mm-hmm.
They set up a GoPro outside, or they set up a camera outside or something like that, and you can see the light next to the doll.
Yeah, I mentioned that because nobody's allowed in the nursery, so nobody went in there to turn it off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they have, like, video footage of the light turning off, because they kind of comment, like, something changed, what turned off, but they don't know.
They had the room that you're not allowed in.
Yeah.
The door is literally locked.
Then they get the word draw through the spirit box, so they decide to do a spirit drawing thing, which is, like, using a planchette with a pencil. I've seen it in, like, Sam and Colby videos, too.
Interesting.
Where you just sort of let the spirits guide the pencil to draw something.
Is that kind of like a free writing thing? And they get what
they call a dead flower. Kind of. But you do it more collectively. I think it's, they were like, oh my God, it looks like a dead flower. And if we're talking to Violet, Violet's a flower. It's a stretch because it just looks like scribbles on the paper.
It's like when you're playing draw something or Pictionary with somebody.
That's why I don't give much credence to it. Yeah.
They're like, how is that a flower?
But while they're doing that, they hear wood creaking in the theater. But yeah. That's where the GoPros all died. So they have nothing to sort of corroborate that.
Mm-hmm.
So they move into the theater to perform impromptu poetry readings one at a time, and the cat balls respond to the idea of sending one of the cameramen up, REM pod going off when he finishes.
Okay.
As if
they're applauding. Clapping. Yeah. Good job.
Yeah.
At least they're jovial.
I think they used the cat balls to decide who was going to go up, like if it flashed or if the REM pod or something responded to, like, the suggestion of who would go.
Mm-hmm.
That was how they decided, and then how they decided what the poetry would be about was they used the ovulus.
No.
So they let the spirits decide what you were going to talk about too.
So they had to make up a poem?
Mm-hmm. On the spot.
Okay. How many of them went roses or red, violets or blue?
None of them did that because you couldn't, like, it literally had to be whatever the spirits picked you to talk about. They only showed, like, the cameraman's poetry reading. Everybody else, they didn't show any of that. They move on to the dining room after this and get nothing, but once they discuss returning to the courtroom, they hear a thud like something fell.
In the dining room or in the courtroom?
They were in the dining room, but they were talking about going back to the courtroom.
Okay.
Now, I haven't mentioned yet, but for most of their time investigating, they have an audio recorder set up with Annabelle in the courtroom. And periodically, they'll show, like, they'll play the EVP.
Okay.
In the video, they'll play it. Like, they don't go check this out. It's something they discovered later. So you can hear sounds of movement periodically getting picked up, as well as an EVP saying, let me out.
No, thanks.
Yeah.
No. How about no?
When they entered the courtroom, they found that the thud they heard from the dining room was one of their cameras that hadn't been recording, but had been knocked over. So it was just on the floor.
It was like, fuck your camera.
It's not even on. Fuck it. They decide to go finish the night with another seance in the courtroom, which they fast-forwarded through, so I'm not sure what message they gave to the spirits.
Okay.
At this point, when they leave the house, Elton reveals that the Annabelle doll is not quite the real one, but a replica he bought, and he brought to the B340 on the Queen Mary to have witches trap all of the negative energy from when they were there into the doll.
Okay.
So it is haunted.
So it's haunted, but it's not the original haunted Annabelle doll, because Tony would never let you have that.
No.
He wouldn't let you touch it.
Absolutely not. No. Next up, we have Mackie and Amanda, who investigated and posted their video back in April of this year. Amanda is a medium that has been along with Sam and Colby on a number of their investigations, though the boys themselves don't appear to have been here yet. Mm-hmm. So maybe they'll show up in the future as well.
I'd be interested to see what they get, because they got a lot of stuff at the Cosmopolitan Hotel.
It would be very interesting.
Yeah.
So after getting a full tour of the house, the girls head upstairs with their guide and immediately hear a light sort of tapping sound that they describe as sounding like a bead or a marble falling on the floor, which their guide simply says, it's just the kids playing.
Okay.
Before carrying on with unlocking the padlock he was working.
Casual.
Soon after that, they hear a sort of metallic sound coming from downstairs in the dining room, like perhaps a fork dropping.
Mm-hmm.
Mackie calls down that if there's a spirit, to give them a sign. There's silence for a moment before another faint metallic sound. Afterward, Mackie mentions having seen what she could only describe as a cattail whipping around the top part of the nursery doorway.
Key.
Yeah. Their guide, Banjo, asks Amanda how she feels in the theater, and she mentions that the room feels like it has the most mellow energy to her, which he says he agrees with because at some point in time, that room had been the family's parlor room.
Mm-hmm.
He calls it a very inviting room and says that there are other rooms in the house that are not so inviting. Mackie asks which rooms those are, and he says for him they are the dining room and master bedroom.
Interesting.
Master bedroom being significant to our guide.
Mm-hmm.
Mackie starts looking behind him, again, everyone's favorite, and says she just sees like a shadow, which could be the dark framed mirrors on the wall, but they venture inside.
Mm-hmm.
Amanda immediately says she feels like she has a pain in her entire back, like a pressure on her back as if she fell off the bed and knocked the wind out of herself.
Oh, wow.
Suddenly, the temperature sensor starts going off on the REM pod that they left at the back of the theater.
Mm-hmm.
Just as Amanda's asking whatever is touching it to step away, the sound stops. Mackie says she hears a voice say like, just behind Amanda, but she doesn't hear it and I couldn't pick it up in the video because it seems to happen at the same time Banjo whispers something like, so cool. So you just hear a whispered, so cool. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure that's the guy. Amanda asks for whatever is there to reach out and touch the red light of the REM pod again, and not long after, it starts to go off again, just after a faint sort of dragging sound can be heard.
No. Like the same kind of dragging sound that the other guys got?
Mm-hmm.
Like dragging furniture?
But a lot more faint, like it was further away from where they were at.
Gross.
Mackie goes back into the master bedroom to place another REM pod, and while she's in there holding it and listening to Banjo talk, the green lights go off briefly. In her hands. She puts the REM pod down and they start setting up some cat balls when the REM pod goes off in the theater, again, stopping as soon as Amanda asks again for them to stop.
Mm-hmm.
Amanda misses the cat ball in the master bedroom doorway going off at first, but when Mackie asks whatever is there to make it go off again, it promptly starts lighting up again. The REM pod in the theater goes off again, stopping before Amanda finishes asking them to stop again, but then the one in the master bedroom starts to go off, and a moment later, that one also stops.
Mm-hmm.
The cat ball in the doorway also starts to light up like something moving through. Mackie introduces herself to Mrs. Whaley and asks for permission to play the piano in the theater.
Mm.
And both REM pods start to go off at the same time. Amanda tells her to stop the REM pods when she's ready for Mackie to start playing, and they stop going off. Mackie starts to play, and Amanda tells Anna to set off any of their devices if she's enjoying the music, and the cat balls start to light up again. While Mackie is talking about suddenly feeling really hot while playing the piano, the temperature sensor on the REM pod in the master bedroom starts to go off, and then their camera overheats and shuts off.
Oh, wow.
Mind you, aside from the one time I mentioned the green light going off, the only thing going off on these REM pods is the temperature sensors.
Mm-hmm.
The entire time.
Weird.
So it's not like something's like walking around it.
Yeah, it's just manipulating the environment. Yeah.
Changing the temperature in the room. Yeah. At this point, they start recording with their phone, and the REM pods keep periodically going off, as well as the cat ball in the master bedroom doorway, but none of the other cat balls. They place their EMF on the first bench in the theater, and it quickly starts to spike up to orange periodically.
Mm-hmm.
Amanda busts out a flashlight to put in the doorway across from the master bedroom, and they also put down the music box. The flashlight turns on or off per their request for a bit, as well as the REM pod in the bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
They're not very good at this point at, like, communicating. They just kind of keep saying, if you're here, touch that. If you're here, do that. If you're here, do this. If you're here, do that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's not, like, a whole lot of intelligent type of communication happening, which is why it's just kind of like, this one starts going off, and this one starts going off, and this starts going off.
They're just asking for signs of a presence, and their devices are going off, just confirming that there's something there.
But... Or the devices are just going off while they're there talking with their guide or whatever, and then immediately responding when they ask them to stop. So that's kind of what the dynamic seems to be, is what's strange. So it's like, it's interesting, the stuff that they're getting, but it's not, if that makes sense.
It's interesting to see, but not to explain.
Right. Mackie asks Amanda how she feels about putting the Boo Buddy in the nursery.
I want a Boo Buddy.
And immediately the master bedroom REM pod starts going off, and the music box goes off for the first time since they put it down.
Oh, wow.
Yep. They finally start talking about going downstairs, and Mackie feels someone put their hand on her side, almost like a child running up to their mother.
Because they want the Boo Buddy.
They pick up like a baby giggle or whimper as they're walking downstairs as well.
Oh.
in the parlor, just outside the legacy room, they hear like a jingle, kind of like a dog collar a couple of times. And not long after they're talking about the child spirits that Amanda has been seeing around the house, Banjo mentions that he's suddenly started feeling incredibly uncomfortable. And like he can't be alone, so they all decide to step outside for a breather.
Sound familiar? Mm-hmm.
So they do. They go outside and they spend a little time outside. In the parlor, they get whiffs of a scent they can only describe as man.
Gross.
And then they get some REM pod activity and one of the cat balls going off when Amanda jokes that she's a lawyer. They pick up a couple thuds in the house as well. They also pick up maybe like a faint woman's chuckle or whimper. While trying to communicate with anything in the parlor, they hear a thud and then the camera loses focus for a decent period of time out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. The REM pod behind Amanda starts going off and she says she can't turn around, but she doesn't feel like it's Yankee Jim that's there, but one of the other criminals.
Mm-hmm.
Up to this point, the flashlight Mackie set up in front of herself had been flickering, but not going off completely until after Banjo mentions the name Juan Verdugo.
There you go.
They talk with something that keeps responding to Yankee Jim with the flashlight in front of Amanda in the parlor and even hear something to describe as spurs.
Okay.
Which you can hear.
Mm-hmm.
When they decide they're going to venture into the courtroom, the REM pods in the dining room and parlor both start going off at the exact same time, and Mackie comments that maybe that's what's happening, is that something is trying to warn them to stay out of the courtroom. Amanda asks whatever is there to make them stop if whatever is in the courtroom is bad, and they go silent soon after, but they decide to go inside anyway. They immediately feel pressure in their heads when they enter, and Amanda feels a hair get pulled out of the back of her head.
Ow.
Mackie asks Amanda how she's feeling in that room, and she says she's feeling terrified and sick. Then they hear like a chair getting moved and a disembodied male voice say, "Let's go." They leave to grab a REM pod, and as they're exiting the courtroom, you can hear a faint, "Hey." And then while they're in the parlor grabbing the REM pod, Mackie sees the flashlight on the judge's bench slowly go out. So now it's just pitch black.
Oh, wow.
Amanda calls out, "If there's something in the courtroom, turn the flashlight back on," and it immediately turns back on. The flashlight continues to go on and off, and they hear a dragging noise and a tapping, while Amanda is stating that they are all protected by God and nothing may touch them.
It's like a challenge accepted.
A fun thing to note is that I don't know how fun it is for the spirits. When they went out to grab that REM pod, they asked again, like, "Can you make these go off if you're warning us or if you don't want us to go back in there?" And nothing happens. I think it's Mackie who comments that the feeling she got from that silence was more like a, "Well, you didn't listen to us the first time, so why would we do it again?"
I mean, yeah, respect the spirits.
Right, like if they're telling you don't go in there, you probably shouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
They finally decide to do a spirit box session in the courtroom. When they ask if anyone's there with them, "Yup" comes through. Mackie asks for their name and they get a "My name's Jim," and possibly "I'm Thomas" when asked again.
Okay.
Then they hear like a hiss and "Stop it now," "Suicide," "I hate you," and "Police" just all come out without any prompting.
What the fuck?
Amanda asks if Jim is there, and you can hear, "I'm here, they hung me, please, and don't kill me," before they turned it off because they were feeling weird.
Mm-hmm.
They describe the feeling as being like a fever where they have chills but feel incredibly hot at the same time.
Interesting.
One of the last significant things they do is Amanda asks if there's a portal in the courtroom, and the flashlight and a nearby cat ball both turn on simultaneously. Just as they're about to leave, Mackie comments that she feels a stinging on her back, but there's no scratches when Amanda looks. However, while Amanda is looking, Mackie feels like a hand get placed on her back, and then they hear a spur sound out toward the general store. As they're walking out, they get the scent of lemon.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. And finally, we have FaZe Rug, aka Brian, who visited and posted his video in August of this year and is joined by Jokey, whom we were first introduced to back in Ghost Adventures, and Sam, a gentleman that we have had the pleasure of becoming acquainted with when we visit.
Sam's great.
The two guys take time to briefly explain some of the history of the house as well as the equipment they have available to them to use, which is pretty standard of how these investigations go these days.
Mm-hmm.
Also, like, the way they do the history and the way they do the investigation in this video is all kind of, like, mixed together,
mm-hmm.
which makes explaining it kind of odd. Sam shows them how to use the dowsing rods by asking the question, is there somebody in this room? And when he takes his thumbs off the rods, they immediately cross, indicating yes.
Mm-hmm.
This is in the courtroom. Before leaving the courtroom, Brian asks if he can place the REM pod in the chair believed to experience the most activity within the jury box. And shortly after he places it, the green light goes off briefly, and then the temperature sensor starts going off.
Mm-hmm.
Next, they place the REM pod on Thomas Whaley's desk, and it starts going off. When they turn off the camera, they catch the tail end of it when they turn the camera on again, because spirits don't like being filmed.
They're shy.
Sometimes. After placing the REM pod on one of the benches in the theater, it immediately starts going off, so they all move away from it to make sure it's clear that none of them are setting it off. After a moment of everyone leaving, it stops, so Brian asks if someone is there to make it go off again, and it reacts immediately. While they're preparing to start a spirit box session, the REM pod is silent, and right before they set up the SB-11, they get one word, go, from the spirit box while the REM pod continues to get random activity. They decide to move the REM pod to Anna Whaley's rocking chair in the nursery so they can communicate with whatever is in the theater through the spirit box, because they believe the spirit is maybe choosing one or the other to communicate through.
Mm-hmm.
Just before they start the spirit box up again, the REM pod in the nursery starts going off again. When Brian asks whatever is there to spike the MF to orange, it does shortly after, and then they start randomly getting some weird melodic beeps from the SB-11 without any sort of verbal response, which is
weird.
Highly unusual.
Melodic beeps, yeah.
Yeah. They hear a bang downstairs and decide to head down there to the parlor, where they place the REM pod on the couch in the spot where Violet died. Brian places his four cat balls in front of the couch. I believe this is the first time Sam ever saw these things as legit ghost hunting items, because now they're standard equipment for him.
There's like more every time.
Yep.
Every like time. They just multiply. He's like, now I have 22.
Congratulations, I have 22. And one of the balls starts going off, and it's the only one that goes off. So like they move it away, they move another ball in its place. Nothing happens. Even when the ball is moved away, it's not going off anymore. When they put it back in its place, it's not going off. So it was just like in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
The clock in the parlor starts going off, something it has never done because it is an artifact.
That does not work.
Yeah, it doesn't tick, nothing. It's just
there.
Sits. Brian and Sam say they heard a whisper or growl or something, and then the REM pod, which was moved back into the courtroom, goes off a few times as well before the group makes their way into the dining room. Brian comments on how cold the room feels. Remember, it's August when they're here.
Yeah, and it should be hot, because in San Diego, August and September are fucking hot.
And there's not really like AC in this place.
I bet that they kept the doors and windows closed to keep out noise pollution, so it gets hot in there.
Mm-hmm. Yep. The cat balls are placed on the dining room table, and one starts going off as Jokey is talking about the Whaley's granddaughter, Marion.
Mm.
One of the guys swears he saw a hand under the dining room table, so they place the music box under the table, and it goes off continuously, so instead of just doing its calibration thing, it never stops. When they turn it to face elsewhere, it stops, and one of the cat balls starts going off. They recalibrate the music box, and it stops going off under the table. But the REM pod in the courtroom starts going off, so they comment on it feeling like a little kid playing a game with them.
Yeah.
They decide to end the video by doing the Estes method in the parlor. The REM pod on the couch starts going off while they're setting up, and when Brian puts on the headphones to begin the Estes method, he comments that it doesn't sound like it's supposed to. So it's not doing the cycling channels thing like it's supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
While Sam is checking it out, both the clock and the REM pod start going off again. They discuss how weird everything is, and the temperature sensor on the SB-11 starts going off at a +2. So it's raising the temperature.
Mm.
They decide to try the spirit box again, just out loud for everyone to hear. And both Sam and Jokey say they hear a woman's voice say, help me, when Brian asks if Violet is in the room, and the REM pod starts going off.
So in terms of the temperature thing, it's interesting that in all the instances where the temperature changed, they would raise the temperature.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder why that's a thing.
The temperature should go down.
Yeah.
It's a demon.
I wonder where that happens.
It's a demon.
It's gotta be.
They also hear the word death followed by go back when Brian asks if they should leave, and then growls come through the speaker. So with that, they all hastily exit the house.
Good, respect them. They say get out, you get out.
Mm-hmm. Lastly, I will leave this bit of Whaley House horror by mentioning that there is a movie called The Haunting of Whaley House that claims to be based on true events. You're more than welcome to check it out if you want to. We'll link it in the show notes. But I couldn't even make it through the first 2 minutes without rolling my eyes right out of my head. So I'm sorry I couldn't bring myself to endure that 90 minutes plus ads because it was on Tubi.
Great.
I couldn't do it for you all. I'm so sorry. So you'll just have to check it out for yourselves and let us know what you thought.
Do it or don't, but if you do it, we're not liable.
But also tell us what you thought, because we'd love to hear it. Why not? But that concludes the hauntings. And so this portion of our tour ended up being quite a bit longer than we were expecting it to be. Although, why we wouldn't expect it, considering how much we love this topic. Who knows?
That is true.
But we're going to make this a part one. And so we will be back with a part two of all of our experiences.
Both personal, with the times we went there on just normal tours, and then our paranormal experiences when we went on paranormal investigations.
Yep, because that's now a thing again. And I've gone on two, Jen's gone on three.
And we're planning on going on more. So, yes. Sam, if you're listening, we will see you again.
And we hope you're not tired of us yet.
If you enjoyed your tour today, please leave us a review on wherever you booked your tour. Reviews help us grow and reach more listeners so we can provide you with more tours. Remember to visit our website at nofillpodcast.com, where you'll have access to our show notes and anything we reference in today's tour. And you'll be able to find and follow us on all of our social media for updates, polls, events, or just interacting with us, which is NopefillCast on Twitter and NopefillPodcast on Instagram and Facebook. If you want to be part of our campfire stories, which are stories you submit for us to read, either fiction or nonfiction, you can submit them through the Contact Us form on our website and select campfire stories, or send an email to us at nopefillpodcast@gmail.com, and be sure to write campfire stories in your subject line so we know what you're emailing us about. No tour is complete without first stopping by the gift shop before you leave. Christmas is coming. Get stuff for all your loved ones, because who doesn't love Nopeville swag?
Yeah, and we have the cutest teddy bears and dogs, like little stuffed animals with little Nopeville shirts.
We have stuffies now to keep you safe at night with your blanket defense.
Exactly.
So visit our gift shop on our website and be sure to pick up a souvenir for yourself and a loved one. And last but not least, gratuity isn't required, but sure is appreciated. We have a couple ways to do that. You can visit us on Buy Me a Coffee and buy us a couple coffees, or visit our Patreon to see how you can support us and get some awesome rewards in return. And we'll see you on our next tour, which is part two of the Wheelie House.
So get ready for that.
Bye.
Excellent. I see most of you returned, and relatively unscathed. Bravo. I hope you enjoyed your visit to Nopeville, and look forward to seeing you again next time.